Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop on this Food Friday, October 11th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome back Chef Josh Kroner from Terrapin Restaurant in Rhinebeck, New York. Chef Kroner has been a driving force behind the farm-to-table movement in the Hudson Valley for over 25 years, which is amazing since he seems pretty young. Working closely with local farmers and growers, Chef Kroner incorporates local organic ingredients in his menu whenever possible. So let's talk about eating local. The number is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Chef Josh Kroner, farm to table, and we'll find out about his travels, etc., etc., all coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. You'll find out it's live as soon as I make my first mistake, which will be coming up shortly. Joining us today is Chef Josh Kroner, executive chef and owner of Terrapin Restaurant in Rhinebeck, New York. Josh has been a leading light in the Hudson Valley farm-to-table movement since he opened Terrapin in 1998. He attended the French Culinary Institute in Manhattan, where he later became an instructor. He also worked under the tutelage of such notable chefs as Emeril Lagasse at the Food Network and Bobby Flay at Manhattan's famed Mesa Grill. Chef Kroner updates his menus seasonally, incorporating local organic ingredients whenever possible. You want to talk farm-to-table and local eating and such with Chef Josh Kroner? Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Chef Kroner, welcome back.
Ray, always good to see you.
I didn't know you worked at the Food Network.
Yeah, that was interesting. It was right in the beginning of my career, and actually in the beginning of the Food Network. It was called the TV Food Network back then.
Oh, yeah?
So they had a test kitchen, and the way that these shows worked back then, particularly, I mean, there was only one chef that worked at the Food Network. It was Emeril Lagasse.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Every other show was a cookbook author, and these people basically didn't know how to cook. But what they would do would be they would come in for, let's say, 3 or 4 days in a row and film an entire month's worth of shows. So you'd do, like, depending on how well they could do the shows, 2 or 3 shows. Or in Emeril's case, because he was a pro, he could do an entire month, which was 21 shows in 3 days.
Wow.
Just bang them out.
Wow.
So I would have, like, certain shows that I would have to prep, you know, for a few days beforehand. I'd have everything ready, everything in, like, little cups that I'd put so he could just put it and go, bam, you know, do his little thing. But it was fun. I mean, it was interesting to kind of have that experience. But eventually I realized this was not kind of really cooking for me, so I wanted to get back into the restaurant.
So this was almost a glorified food internship in a way. What did you learn, though, from
I'll tell you my best lesson. And this was Julia Child's 80th birthday. They did a Julia Child special. So Julia Child came on.
Cool.
And on the show that I was prepping for Julia, she made hollandaise. And she made hollandaise by making a blender hollandaise. And she basically taught me how to do this. And I still use Julia Child's method. Yeah, it's great. But the funny thing about Julia Child, so I saw her, you know, this is an icon of the industry. I'm in my 20s. And, you know, she was 80 and she looked like she was 150.
Right.
Like she was big. She had kind of a hunchback. Her face was kind of melting off.
Melting off.
And I was like, oh my God. But then she was sharp as a tack. Like she really was. She was so, like, together and really a beautiful, warm person. It was a pleasure to meet her.
You know, it's funny. You go back to some of these old videotapes of her shows. I mean, they go back so far.
Yeah.
She was the progenitor of all this food TV.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some great stuff that Julia and Julia, it was a kind of this movie about this woman who made all of Julia Child's recipes from her first cookbook.
Yeah.
And, you know, also had at the same time Julia Child played by Meryl Streep with Stanley Tucci, kind of in the past and in the present. It was a terrific movie.
Julia Child, Meryl Streep doesn't look much like Julia Child. Did they do a lot of makeup in that movie?
They did, and she killed it, as Meryl Streep generally does.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe that. The number to call here is 800-348-2551. It's Chef Josh Kroner today, and you were just out on the road, huh?
I was. Well, actually, I out on a plane.
Right.
I came back recently. I try to take food trips.
Yeah.
You know, as a chef, when I travel at all, food is always the focus. So my wife and I had an opportunity to go to Spain. So we were in Spain for a few weeks, and I really tried to take a deep dive into Spanish food. And at one point, I had an Airbnb, and I'm going to the market. And the markets in Spain is like, that's the best thing about
really,
Spain.
Really, why?
You know, here we have a system where we go into a supermarket and we buy everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we're lucky, we can go to an expensive place like Whole Foods where they have different types of food. The way that they buy food in Spain is completely different. They have in every town a central market, Mercado Central, and there's different levels, like one level just filled with fish vendors. So you go through and there's so much many different options for fish, and you find the one guy you like and go there and he'll have fish for you. You know, it's basically like the fish market at Whole Foods times 50.
Wow.
in one building. And then you go downstairs, it's all meats, like meat markets, and then olive markets and an egg person. And then you go out to the produce vendors and it's like a giant farmer's market. And this happens every single day, except for Sunday. That's there. They don't like to do that sort of thing on Sunday. But so people, you just go there, you buy the food you're going to make for the day, go home, and then you go back in the morning.
You know, it occurs to me that this is probably a much lengthier process than making a list, going to the grocery store here. And it probably speaks to sort of a different mindset in parts of Europe than here in the U.S. of A., where it's rush, rush, rush all the time.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's so interesting the difference in food in Europe and the United States. And I think this really typifies it. In Europe, it's so much more Whole Foods like this, where it's a slower process. Just like you say, it's not like just rip open a package, throw it in the microwave, and then you have dinner, where it's a process where you're going to make dinner. And even if you have a job, you know, kind of that process of cooking food and having a home-cooked meal. Going out to dinner in the United States, I mean, thank God for me as a restaurateur, you know, it's become like something that so many people do regularly.
Right.
I mean, we go back to when we were kids, dining out was like, what, once a month if you were lucky, and
yeah.
It'd be something like Friendly's or
Valley's Steakhouse, yeah. Which was right up here on Central.
Oh, that would have been a treat.
Oh, that was a big day.
But you know, nowadays it's more common because that's the way Americans work, and you know, it's a very different system. I was just actually I had started this food writing blog, so I'm doing lot of food writing, and one of the items that I wrote about was how people expect like going to Italy. And I travel. I'm Italian, actually a dual citizen.
Kroner?
Kroner is my father's.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So Giacconi was my mother.
Oh, that would be a little more Italian.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
And so I've been to Italy a lot. And you think of Italy like, oh, my God, Italy, the food is the best. The restaurants are just so great. And that's not necessarily untrue. But the fact is that there's only one kind of restaurant in Italy. It's Italian food. And
really?
The Italian restaurants, the Italian restaurants are basically all have the same menu. Pasta, you've got your antipasto platter, which is basically salami and cheese. You've got, you know, fried calamari, maybe a handful of things. It's really like in a small town, you'll have six restaurants. Every single one has the exact same menu.
But Rome, I mean, you must be able to find a Japanese restaurant and this and
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean, you go to a place like Rome, you have a better options, but the Japanese restaurants will be terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, you want to find a taco, forget about it.
Really? You're
yeah.
kidding me.
It's awful. And, you know, I've thought as an Italian citizen, well, maybe when I retire, I'll move to Italy. I love to eat out so much. I can't even imagine Italy for that reason.
That is so interesting. You know, I don't know. Do you know Anissa Wahid from
No.
Tara Kitchen? And she's just an amazing entrepreneur, and she does Moroccan food at Tara. And she opened recently, maybe within the last year. It's been a while since she's been on. The first Moroccan restaurant in India. All of India, you'd think there'd be one. Now, this blows my mind that in Italy, really, you just get Italian
food. You know, that's
food.
Actually kind of something that's very specific to Italians. Because Italians are all about the rules, the food rules. Like, for example, you try to put Parmesan cheese on any pasta that's got seafood on it. Oh, my God, that's a no-no.
I'm sorry, say that again?
Parmesan cheese or any kind of cheese on top of pasta that has seafood in it. So if
why?
You,
I put Parmesan on everything.
I hear you. You know, you do that in Italy, though. They don't like it.
Really?
I mean, you go to a cafe at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and you want a cappuccino? That's sacrilege. You don't have milk in your coffee after 12.
Well, do you have a list of rules?
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
You don't want to offend.
There absolutely is, and you need to study them.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable. But at the same time, they frown on ethnic restaurants. So it's a whole thing where it's just really hard for, like, if you have a Chinese immigrant to try to open a Chinese restaurant. There are Chinese restaurants, but there are not many. Mexican restaurants, zero. Except for maybe Rome, Florence, couple, but they're not good.
You know, we have a lot to talk about, but I want to follow up on this, and we will do that in a minute. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. Ostensibly, the show is about farm to table, but Chef Josh Kroner and I are going in different directions. Hang in there. Give us a call. 800-348-2551. Nelson Esposito and Quintana there. That's beautiful stuff. 800-348-2551. You know what else is beautiful? You have done miraculous work in our lockbox in the last couple of weeks. We've done some pretty cool special roundtable panels, and we've pitched for the fund drive around them. And we're already at, I think, about $460,000, and you have done amazing. Now, we can keep it going this weekend. You can pledge anytime, wamc.org, to make your secure online pledge. Let me tell you something. Fund drive starts Monday morning at 6 a.m. We have a long way to go, but because of you, we have done really well. If it's not you, do it this weekend, wamc.org. We're joined today by Chef Josh Kroner, executive chef and owner of Terrapin Restaurant in Rhinebeck, New York. How's the restaurant?
It's been great, really. I've actually, this is a great time of year for me. The fall is a wonderful bounty. I mean, it's like one of these seasons where you have so much fresh produce coming in. I mean, obviously, you think of the harvest festivals in the fall.
Oh, yeah.
The harvest for the restaurant, too, is the same thing. So I can put together great specials. I mean, I just switched to my fall menu.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. Let's talk about that first, but then I'm going to just take a note because I want to ask you about a specific Italian food question. But now, how'd you change your menu for the fall?
Well, you know, I do a couple things every year that are real crowd pleasers, something I'll never change. One is the pumpkin ravioli. So I've got a...
I think I've tried that.
You know, it's been on the menu. It's a brown butter sherry sauce, and we have some sun-dried tomatoes. It's really nice. And, you know, people clamor for it, so...
Can I ask you a question? What is with the... Now, those are good because I've had them, and the sherry sauce is what makes it for me. What is the craze in this country about pumpkin spice this and pumpkin that? It drives me up the wall.
I agree with you. I couldn't agree with you more. This, I mean, pumpkin spice, I guess, is cloves and cinnamon.
It's not even pumpkin?
Well, it's not pumpkin at all. It's the pumpkin spice.
Oh, like in a...
So, that would be maybe allspice. So these are the spices that traditionally go into pumpkin pie. So, you know, Dunkin' Donuts says the pumpkin spice iced latte, which is super popular. So
now with my daughters.
Yeah, so now that kind of takes off, and my daughters too.
Yeah.
Just all about the pumpkin spice. I don't get it.
Well, okay, you know, at least we older folks agree
yeah,
on that
exactly
stuff.
Exactly,
you know?
Right.
So anyway, what else is on the new menu?
Okay, so the other... staple is my golden nugget squash soup, which is a vegan soup that I make with coconut milk. And it's kind of got this lemongrass that I infuse into it, and it's people love it.
When you do a recipe like that, that is vegan friendly and vegan recipe, do you do that for the taste, or do you do that for an economic reason where, okay, I gotta please the
vegans?
You
know, there's absolutely an element that I want to make the restaurant vegan friendly, vegetarian friendly.
Yeah.
There are lots of people, not even people that are vegans or vegetarians, that like to have vegan or vegetarian food. There's a lot of people that are non-dairy that are happy to have vegan food because they know it's not going to have dairy
especially
in it.
Especially a soup.
So I could take a squash soup recipe that might have chicken stock in it, and then I'm trying to play with it. A lot of times what I do is use like a vegetable stock. So you use vegetable stock instead of chicken stock. But you got to add, like, what are you going to do instead of cream? Coconut milk comes in, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, depending on the dish, but it really works wonderfully with the balance between the squash flavors and the coconut milk. You know, coconut is one of those things where if you taste the coconut, then it's out of balance. You know, you want it to be kind of like underneath there so it doesn't taste coconutty. You know, so it's really, it's a squash soup. It's got to taste like squash. What I want from the coconut is more to add the creaminess without adding the coconut flavor too much.
Now, a couple few weeks ago, I did a vegetarian show, and it was fantastic. We had mushroom. It was made of mushrooms, but it looked like and tasted like and felt like steak. But now this was, I guess this was an attempt to imitate meat. But when you do a dish that's vegetarian or vegan, are you going for something original? Are you throwing out the whole ruse of trying to copy something that is meat-based?
Not necessarily. I mean, for example, I have now three vegetarian entrees on my menu. One is a pumpkin risotto.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's not necessarily copying meat. I have another one, which is I call my farmer's market crepe, with kind of it's got a cheese sauce on it. I also make that with a non-dairy sauce for vegans. And that's just filled with market vegetables. So it's just sautéed market vegetables with like onions and a little sherry, and then I put it in a buckwheat crepe. So it's absolutely not. But then I have another dish, which is kind of a take on my wife is Dominican.
Yeah.
So I wanted to do something in honor of her. So I made like the classic dish of Dominican Republic is rice and beans. So it's a rice and beans type dish, but that would have meat in it. It would have lots of meat because that's how they do it. So instead of meat, I put tempeh, which are fermented soybeans, which have a lot of protein and also kind of that chewy texture. Yeah, a little bit like, and I think it works wonderfully with that.
Fantastic.
And it's funny because I'm not a vegan or a vegetarian, but I order that all the time when I go to the restaurant.
Just because it's good.
Yeah, because it's good and, you know, it's healthy and I'm obviously a meat eater, but I, at the same time, try to eat a lot of vegetables as well.
Good for
trying
you.
To stay alive, you know what I mean?
Chef Josh Kroner is our guest today, executive chef and owner of Terrapin Restaurant in Rhinebeck, New York. How often do you eat out?
Well, not counting my restaurant. I eat at my restaurant quite often, but I eat out a couple times a week probably. I mean, I find inspiration by eating out. So I'm always trying to try new places. So I want to see what's going on. You know, I feel like if I live in a vacuum as a chef, I'll stagnate.
Yeah.
But if I get out and I see things and I try new things, and that inspires me, you know, like this trip to Spain that I was talking about, you know, we ate out a lot and a lot of these dishes inspired me. You know, I have on my menu different things that I had in Spain that I wanted to do my own version, you know, and that's the kind of thing that I get from eating out. It's just this, you know, it's as a chef, you know, inspiration is something you definitely need.
Chef Josh Kroner is our guest. We'll get to the phones in a second. 800-348-2551. The email is voxpop@wamc.org. Yeah, Allison in Carmel, New York is going to take you to task here about your comments on Italy. She says, wait, that's Staten Island, not Italy. Ray, I was listening to my favorite show, Food Friday, and saddened to hear the food of Italy described this way. Italy has Florence, grilled steak, Bologna, the most amazing pasta cooked in eggplant water, then the combination, Sicily, Naples, pizza, Tuscany. I have only been there once, but I know it's way more than what the chef says. And that's from Allison, who says, land of Carmel, land of nothing but Italian restaurants, the likes of which were clearly described. So I guess Carmel, New York, which is a wonderful place, has a lot of Italian restaurants. So what do you say to Allison?
Well, I would never say that you can't get good food in Italy. There's wonderful food in Italy. And Florence is known for its steak restaurants. You know, Bologna is a great place to get pasta, but there's pasta in every restaurant. You know, but the thing is, like, after you've been there for a little while and you want a salad, That is a totally different story.
Okay, all right.
And, you know, the thing is, that's not the way the Italians eat. It's not like they don't eat salads and they don't eat vegetables and they eat only pasta. They just don't go out to dinner that much.
Right.
You know, going out to dinner is a special thing. You're going to go have pasta when you go out to dinner. And the other 29 days in that month, you're going to have, you know, vegetables and you're going to have a home-cooked meal. I mean, the markets in Italy, a lot like the markets in Spain that I was talking about, wonderful markets with just a bounty of fresh vegetables, fish and meats and all kinds of great stuff. If you're going to cook at home, Italy's a wonderful place. I'm talking about dining out on a regular basis. You're not going to find the diversity anywhere in the world, in fact, that you find in New York. But throughout Europe, the diversity is much, much better. In Spain, in London, or England in general, I mean, there's plenty of like ethnic restaurants everywhere.
I wonder why it is, though.
I'm telling you, if what you say is true. It's the food rules.
Really?
I'm sure of it, yeah.
The food rules. Okay, you're going to have to enumerate those at some point. But let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551. Mary is in Amsterdam. Hello, Mary.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Hey, I have a small bed and breakfast outside of Amsterdam, and I often make poached eggs for breakfast, and I would love that simplified hollandaise method that you talked about. If you could give the once-over on that.
The Julia Child method. So it's very simple, actually.
Yeah.
So what hollandaise is you are emulsifying butter into a sauce. So if you take butter and you heat it up, it is oil that separates. So you've got oil and solids. If you emulsify it, so you're creating an emulsification which basically binds it, so it becomes a smooth sauce where the solids and the oils are all together. Now, the classic way of doing that, and you use egg yolk to make this emulsification, is you take the egg yolk with a little bit of water, usually some sort of thing to help, like a tiny bit of mustard and some vinegar, lemon juice, and you start whisking over a double boiler. So you've got this bowl over a double boiler because you got to keep it warm, and you whisk in very, very slowly, drop at a time of the butter, hot butter, but not too hot.
Right.
About 140 degrees. Whisk, 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 whisk. So it could take 10 minutes to make a little.
Right.
You know, once you're done. And if you don't do it right, which is very easy to do in this way, it breaks.
And then you're going to start again.
And then, yeah, you basically have to start all over again. Now, this method that I use, you melt the butter. Once again, it should be about 140. You take the egg. Usually I put a little bit of water in there, a little bit of lemon juice. And put it in a blender and just pour the butter in a thin stream.
Amazing.
And just turn the blender up so that it keeps moving. Boom. You have hollandaise in seconds.
Mary.
Are you using salted butter or adding salt?
Well, I mean, you could use unsalted butter or salted butter. You're still going to have to add salt probably. You want to taste it. I mean, I like to add a little bit of sweetness to my hollandaise, so I'll add a couple drops of honey.
Would Julia Child do that?
Not as far as I can remember. Okay. That's, you know, that's one of those secrets of, like, chefs adding sweet to dishes, and I could talk about this a little bit later.
Yeah.
But as far as the hollandaise goes, you know, I put also some hot sauce in it. I like that balance as well.
Yeah. Mary, you want to follow up a little more?
No, I'm going to hang up, but I wanted to say that I'm going to go to Portugal, and I wondered if you'd ever been to Portugal and how the food is there.
Yeah, Portugal has wonderful food.
So thank you very much. I'm going to hang up and listen.
Thanks, Mary.
Portugal's great. I speak fluent Spanish, and so I gravitate towards Spain. Is great for me.
Mm-hmm.
But Portugal is very similar in a lot of ways. It was terrific. I was in Lisbon, great restaurants in Lisbon.
So, you know, again, I hate to keep coming back to this sort of theme we talked about with Italy basically having these rules. but they're not written down. This is just sort of folk rules.
It's not written down, but they're very consistent with these rules. So
no parm on fish dishes.
So I have a Substack, which is a blog that I've started writing. And I wrote an article specifically just about this issue. And I talk a lot about the rules that they have in Italy and how it's not just rules. There's red tape. Like, Italy is classic for red tape in businesses. Like, to get a business started in Italy is not easy. Now, if you're starting an ethnic restaurant, it's easy how that could be derailed. And that's kind of how Italians are. If they don't approve of something, and food culture is very, very rigid in Italy. Not to say it's not good. To address that, the comment that we talked about earlier, oh, it's wonderful. I mean, you can have the best pasta you've ever had in your life. You can have, I've had some fantastic meals at restaurants in Italy, but I'm saying that is very limited. It's very limited in terms of, like, you want a taco? No, not going to happen. Even like French food or, you know, it's just, it's not there.
But what about the influences? For instance, I'll bring up Anissa Wahid again. Morocco is one of those great places where you get the confluence of European and French and Middle Eastern and a bunch of and African and a bunch of different things. Europe is so many different cultures. I'm absolutely astonished at what you are saying.
I mean, Europe is a lot of cultures, but each country has its own culture. And some countries like Italy are very, very protective over their culture. So they don't want influences from outside affecting their culture because they're proud of their culture and they want to keep their culture pure.
Okay.
And, you know, that's the way Italy is. And, you know, there are certainly people that break through, a lot of, you know, these big chefs that do things that would be considered somewhat fusion of different, you know, different ingredients on like a high level. We're talking super expensive restaurants, though, that have gotten recognition maybe through Michelin or other places. But you're talking about your regular restaurants you're going to go to, especially in smaller towns.
Right.
They're all the same.
You know, are you the – you're not that fond of the term fusion cuisine, right?
Well, I feel like it's just a word that's been derided. So it's like – it's originally came out maybe in the 90s where it's like, hey, we're having fusion cuisine, and then it started becoming frowned on. But – when I look at the reality of what American food is, so
it's
I'm an American restaurant. So what is American food? Well, America is a melting pot of cultures. We have all kinds of cultures here. And I've been exposed to so much. Obviously, I've said I have an Italian background. My mother was a great Italian cook. My uncle had a restaurant. My grandfather had an Italian restaurant. I learned Italian food. But at the same time, I love Japanese food. I love Mexican food. I was trained in a French culinary school. I have all of these different influences. Is it fusion? No, I don't look at it necessarily that way, but I have techniques that I've developed through French cooking, through the Italian training that I had, and I use the ingredients that I have available to me, which is really everything from every ethnic culture. That's the way it is in the United States. Plus, I'll say, hey, I just had this amazing dish at this Japanese restaurant. I want to make something like that. This is actually a question I get all the time. It's like, well, what kind of food do you make?
Right.
I make food that I like to eat.
So simple. So simple.
If I like to eat it, it might find its way on my menu. And people say, well, what do you like to eat on your menu? Well, it turns out everything, because that's why I make my menu the way it is.
You're in pretty good shape, man. Yeah. I mean, how do you go out and eat everything?
Right.
I don't know. You know, all right, let's go. Let's take one call. We'll take a break. I'll tell you one thing. Josh Kroner never fails to entertain here. Harry in New Paltz, you're on.
Hi, thank you so much for the engaging conversation.
Oh,
I'd love to hear your thoughts on how consumer behavior, chef, has changed around plant-based cuisine, like in America and around the world in your travels, and how it's affected, you know, your business and, you know, how you see it changing in the future.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, and I mentioned this earlier, vegetarian food is very important to have on my menu, and I make a big effort. And, you know, we have our entire menu kind of coded so you can see what's vegan, what's vegetarian, and also what could be made vegan or vegetarian. You know, for example, we have a pasta, which is one of my, you know, longest-lived dishes. Actually, it was a dish made by my grandfather originally. I call it Uncle Vinny's special rigatoni. It's got chicken in it, and it's made with chicken stock. Now, it says made vegan or possibility to make vegan. Now, if you're a vegan, there's no chicken, and there's no chicken stock.
Right.
So everything else is plant-based. I you know, I would never use, and this is something that I see a lot of, which I've tried and I've thought about putting on my menu, like the Beyond Burger,
which are very good.
They're very good. But I've decided that that's really not the type of food that I do because I don't do processed food, and that's highly processed food. So I have a veggie burger on my menu, but it's veggie burger made with veggies that are fresh veggies, and I make burgers out of them. You know, that's kind of like, that's more along the way that I would want to make a veggie burger. Not that I'm going to compare and say, oh, it tastes like this. I mean, the Beyond Burger actually kind of tastes like a hamburger.
If you do it on the grill, it certainly does.
Mine certainly does not taste like a hamburger, but at the same time, it's good.
Yeah.
I've had people order it with bacon.
Oh.
Veggie burger with bacon happens all the time.
That's a little odd.
So people want to have, like, the taste of the burger, of the veggie burger, but they want a little, you know, meat on top of it.
Harry, you want to follow up?
No. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts, and I'm very inspired by Therapin. I'm actually a business owner myself in New Paltz here, and inspired by your journey.
Thank you, Harry.
Thanks so much for the call. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. That's the number. Chef Josh Kroner is here. Who knows where we'll go next? I don't know. We'll find out. Don't forget the lockbox, WAMC.org. The fun drive starts Monday at 6 a.m. Oh, you're going to love it. But if you want to make it shorter, pledge now, WAMC.org. Chef Josh Kroner joins us on this edition of Food Friday. Chef Kroner is the executive chef and owner of Terrapin Restaurant in Rhinebeck, New York, which has now been there, over 20 years?
Yeah, it's been in Rhinebeck for over 21.
It's amazing, isn't it?
My Time restaurant flies. Can drink.
You're old enough to drink. Yeah, you know, just quickly, we'll go to Karen in Pine Hills in just a moment. But this veggie burger thing. You say it doesn't taste like a burger. Well, first question is, why call it a burger?
It's shaped like a burger.
It's shaped like a burger.
And it fits on a burger bun.
Yeah, and what's in it?
I mean, I do a lot of fresh vegetables. There's some beans, quinoa, kind of hold the whole thing together. You know, a lot of seasonings. You know, it's definitely flaxseed also is good because flaxseed kind of gives it a consistency where it's tight like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going for taste with something like that. Like I said, I loved the Beyond Burger when I had it.
Yep.
I certainly considered putting it on the menu. But, you know, my whole thing is like I don't have processed food on my menu.
Right.
And I can't just all of a sudden say, well, it's vegetarian. I'm going to stick some processed food on the menu. So I was like, not going to do it. And this can be local food. You know, it's local food and it's in a burger.
Yeah. You know, and we'll get back quickly to your menu changes now. What is happening locally? What food are you sourcing now?
I mean, it is so much right now. I use this farms to table, which is actually something, and they have a wholesale division, they have a retail division. I could give them a plug.
Sure.
Patricia Wynn runs this. It's a wonderful way to get farm food. And it's an app where you can see absolute, she has 100 different, you know, farms and things listed. So she deals with all of these different farms. And you can pick what you want, put it together, kind of make an order of all these different farms. And that's what I do. You know, I'll go through and I'll be like, wow, that's in season. And you know, I used to do, like you said, you know, 20 years ago or 25 years ago when I first started doing farm to table and nobody was doing it.
Right.
That meant going to the farms.
Yeah.
That was the only way to do it.
We talked about that.
You had to actually go to the farm if you wanted to get farm food. Now, with places like Farms to Table, it's made this process so much better. And then they do the middleman. They deliver everything to me so that I don't have to run out to the farms anymore, but I'm still getting the farm food. I mean, I'm sure I'm paying more for it, but it's worth it.
But, I mean, chefs can be notoriously a little picky. I mean, I'm sure that there was an advantage to you going to the farms and saying, oh, yeah, I want that, that,
you know,
that, and
it's
that.
Actually really important for me to at least visit every farm once.
Ah.
And the reason I like that is that You know, you can talk about organic, like, oh, I only eat organic food, people will say. But that doesn't mean anything. Organic is a word that has been taken over by the federal government. So if you want to use the word organic, you have to apply to the federal government.
Oh, you're
by
kidding
the
me.
Federal government standards to use the word organic, which could mean whatever they decide it to mean.
And it probably could change.
It can change. I mean, there was a famous story about this, which was shortly after they developed this organic labeling, the USDA, where there was a congressperson from Georgia who had a constituent who had a chicken farm, and he wanted to have organic chickens. And according to the statute in the organic code, to have organic chickens, you had to feed them organic feed, which makes sense.
Okay.
Well, the organic feed was going up, so he got his congressperson to stick into some other bill that if the price of organic corn goes above a certain amount, they can substitute regular corn and still call it organic.
So, and you can fool the populace.
Right. So, getting back to the farms themselves, when you go to a farm, it doesn't matter whether they're certified organic or not. You can see what they're doing. You can see if they're using pesticides. You can see what type of conditions are at this farm, how they're, you know, and that to me really says so much more than a word on a package that could mean anything.
Chef Josh Kroner joins us today from Terrapin Restaurant in Rhinebeck, New York. Karen in Pine Hills has been waiting a long time. The Hollandaise thing has legs. Go ahead, Karen.
Yes, hi. Just to tell you about the Hollandaise sauce, do not be afraid to make Hollandaise sauce. Have some cold water right next to you. It curdles, and you just add a tablespoon of cold water and whip, 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 and it comes back to life. And rather than taking out the blender and doing that whole thing, I do a little egg white over the gas. And just until it kind of starts to get a little warm, I throw in the butter. And then if, gosh, you turn away or you distract it and it curdles, just put in an ice cube or something and whip, 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 and it comes back. So never be afraid of Hollandaise sauce.
Oh, I'm afraid.
And I just curdle it for fun.
Are you
Don't be afraid,
Chef?
Never be afraid of Hollandaise sauce.
I'm not afraid.
So what do you think about what Karen said?
I'm sure it works.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly from the scale of which, you know, if you're making a pound of butter Hollandaise sauce, it would take a long time to do it like that.
Ah, I see what you mean.
It would take seconds in a blender. You know, if you're making a couple tablespoons of butter Hollandaise sauce, that's probably a better way to do it. You can't even do that in a blender, in fact.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that makes a point. Well, Karen, thanks a lot. Have a great weekend. Appreciate it. Now, when Julia Child did it, was it her own idea?
Really didn't get to ask Julia that specific, but I'd never seen it before. I'd gone through culinary school, and everybody I knew made it the same way by whisking it. And I saw that, and I was like, well, look at this. This is going to save me some time.
I wonder if her old mentors from France looked askance at that.
Right. She went to the Cordon Bleu school.
Oh, no. Mais oui. All right, let's go to Ed in Copake. Ed, you're on with Chef Josh Kroner. Go ahead.
Hi, I've been cooking a long time, baked bread a lot, but as far as pizza dough goes, I bought double zero Italian flour and whatever, and I can't get that nice crusty outside and elastic inside. Is there some secret that's being kept from the public here?
Okay, so with pizza dough, I mean, there's a couple secrets to that. I mean, my favorite recipes for pizza dough use a no-knead recipe. So this is a very slow rise, so it's going to take, you know, I like to do it overnight. So if you look at a basic pizza dough recipe, it's going to say for 7 cups of flour that you add a tablespoon of active yeast, right? With this method, you're going to add like a quarter of a teaspoon of active yeast to all that, and you basically just put the flour and the yeast and the water, salt, maybe some oil, and you just mix it up with a wooden spoon and you let it sit there. You know, it's going to get kind of like a little crusty on top. It's going to rise really slowly because the yeast is a small amount. It takes a long time, and that slow development creates a different type of dough, and it's way better.
Interesting. Ed?
And do you leave it overnight outside the refrigerator?
Yes, absolutely. Right. You have to leave it outside of the refrigerator because it won't it won't rise if it's at refrigerator temperature.
Okay.
Well, that's the secret I've been looking for.
You know what? I would suggest just Googling a no-knead pizza dough recipe. There was Leahy is a New York Times food writer who wrote a recipe, which is excellent. So that's readily available.
All right, Ed, thanks a lot. Appreciate the call. Chef Josh Kroner joins us from Terrapin Restaurant. I promise this is it on the holidays. Dave in West Stockbridge has another comment, but I have one question for you. And this is a simple question, but I'm a simple man. I'm well familiar with testing the steak on the grill or the chicken with a meat thermometer. How do you, when you're making the hollandaise, how do you know the butter's at 140 degrees?
Well, you can do it the same way with a instant read thermometer.
In other words, you can put it in liquid and it'll work.
Oh, yeah. Instant read thermometers are great like that. And I like to use these new digital ones. It's instant. You know, the old school ones, you know, you had to sit there and hold it for, you know, maybe 10, 20 seconds before you would get an accurate reading.
Right.
Digital ones is instant. You can see that. I mean, also, I mean, I could stick my finger in it and know that it's 140 degrees.
Oh, how?
I mean, just sensitivity. Experience. I mean, like talking about meat temperatures, for example, like I don't need to use a thermometer to tell meat temperatures either.
Listen, man, I was like you and I grill. I'm not overly boasting about it, but I'm pretty good at it. Okay. But a few years ago, I got my wife a meat thermometer for some project or whatever she was. Now we use it on everything we grill. We have not failed. Medium filet mignon or whatever.
You know, it's funny because I feel like by touching the meat, I can tell exactly what the temperature is. And that's what chefs like to do. Cooks like to do that because that's kind of like, you know, shows you how good you are, what your chops are.
Yeah.
I don't let my cooks do that.
Interesting.
I want them to use a meat thermometer.
So you don't?
I don't want to leave that to chance.
You know what? Probably from a health code, it's probably a wise idea anyway.
Yeah,
huh?
For sure. Well, I mean, they have gloves on so they can touch the food.
No, I'm talking about temperature. Meat temperatures can sometimes run askance of afoul of state regulations and whatnot. Okay, so I said no more hollandaise, but let's go to West Dock.
Bring it on.
Dave, you're on the West West Stockbridge Hollandaise Show. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking the call. Hi, guys.
Hey.
First, I want to say, Ray, I love your taste of music. It's awesome.
Thanks,
you're probably one of the few people out there who can stump me. And it's great to listen to you, and you're hilarious.
Thank you.
Okay, so I do not mean to step on the toes of the previous caller regarding hollandaise, but I just have to say, Chef, I am with you. I'm in my early 60s. And I discovered blender hollandaise out of the joy of cooking when I was like 20 years old. And the first time I made it, it was fantastic. It's the best way to do it. And you can also make béarnaise sauce the same way because it's the same basic ingredients.
Right.
You just add tarragon instead of lemon. And I also put a pinch of cayenne in there instead of hot sauce. But I just wanted to say, I think, you know, the blender hollandaise sauce is absolutely the way to go.
Well,
I do agree with you.
Okay. Well, solidarity. Hey, yeah. Dave, man, have a great weekend. Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. Chef Josh Kroner. Isn't it funny, man? So many times on this show, we'll say, on the science forum, I hang my clothes out to dry outside. They smell cleaner. And then there'll be 40 questions about that.
I've seen this many times on this show.
Yes, yeah. Well.
And I've been here for many of them.
Welcome again to my world, brother. Let's go to Andreas and Troy. You're on.
Hey, thanks for having me. I was just going to say I got a ThermoPen a while back, and mostly I was thinking about using it for things like meat and stuff when I first got it. But I found it's been really helpful for everything from when you check like how much a bread's cooked, you can kind of tell by the temperature that it sits sort of below water boiling temperature right until it's already cooked, and suddenly it sort of shoots up so you can more easily tell even like dough temperature, And you can use it in like stuff like candy making and sugar cooking. It seems like, and even for stuff like when I do lattes at home, and you can check the milk temperature with it. I found like once you have it, you find out you can use it for everything.
Yeah.
It is absolutely a wonderful invention, these digital thermometers that can be used for so much.
All right. Hey, thank
you. It only takes like a second or two. Yeah.
It's incredible. Thanks a lot. Appreciate the call. It's upped our game at the grill. I mean, big time. Well, I was always afraid. Okay. You can look at the meat and touch it. And it's, to me, I was always afraid to do chicken or afraid to do pork because you're always so afraid. Oh, trichinosis, this and that, which is not so much of a thing anymore anyway. But with a meat thermometer, it's perfect.
I'm going to give one little piece of advice about meat thermometers and meat.
Yeah.
And this is the biggest mistake people make. So let's say you want to make a medium rare steak.
Yeah.
So you got your meat thermometer, you got your steak that's sitting on the grill, and you stick it in there. Medium rare for steak, it's going to be about 130 degrees.
Right.
So you wait till it gets to be 130 degrees, and you take it off. And then you put it on the plate, you get all ready, you cut into it, the blood runs all over the plate, and it looks like it's medium well. What happened?
Yes, what happened?
So what happened is that steak is 130 degrees in the center, but the outside edges are 200 degrees. Mm-hmm. And as you go in, it's kind of like a contour map where it goes all the way down to 130 degrees. When you take it off, eventually it's all going to balance out and it's going to be, let's say, 160 degrees. So what you have to do is you have to take it off at 120 degrees, let it sit, rest for 5 to 10 minutes, depending on how thick the meat is, and then you have a perfect steak.
All right, so it gets, all right. You validated what my wife has said all along, and I said, you know, this is against physics. How can it get warmer inside when it's off the grill? And she said, you must let it rest.
And wife is always right.
Well, I think you're right. All right, let's go to Kevin real quick in Averill Park. Kevin, you're on.
Hey, Ray, how you doing? I was wondering if I could ask the chef about some sourcing questions for some products.
Oh, yeah. Is this Kevin from the French restaurant across the river?
Yes, it is.
How you doing, my friend?
Through the woods.
Hey, welcome. All
doing
right,
very well. You're a busy man yourself right now, Ray.
Yes, I am. All right, go ahead. You only got a minute here.
All right, real quick. There's a source down, I think it's North Shore, Suffolk County, for escargot. I think it's the only place in the state, if not the country, that does escargot. And I was wondering if Chef's ever used it, and if he has, what his opinions were.
I've enjoyed escargot, but I have never bought any for my restaurant.
Really?
Okay, because
that's kind of a niche French item.
It's a little bit pricier than the stuff in the cans.
Kevin, you haven't been on in a while, so do a plug for your restaurant.
Oh, boy, here we go. Ty's Bistro American. We're out in Averill Park, New York, actually a little bit past Averill Park in Glass Lake. We're right on the lake, and half the menu is traditional country-style French, and the other half is what I call corresponding American dishes.
I like it. Hey, man, good luck. Thanks a lot. We're out of time here. Kevin's a great guy. He's been on this show before. All right, Josh Kroner, we are out of time. How do people find out about Terrapin Restaurant? How do people find out about your blog and not the blog, the Substack? I will put a link to that, but tell us over the air.
Okay, so Terrapin Restaurant, you can find us on the web at terrapinrestaurant.com. My Substack blog is Josh's Substack. And I have a bunch of food writing that I've done, a couple articles. Like, I talked a lot about that Italy thing.
Yeah.
But there's some other stuff that I talk about. I'm really having fun with food writing.
Cool.
So that's kind of a new thing. I mean, just to plug quickly, we have a few things at Terrapin I wanted to talk about.
Sure.
We do Thanksgiving to go, which is coming up. So if anybody's interested in that, I do a wonderful, all the sides, no turkey.
Yeah.
But that way you cook your turkey at home, get all the sides from me. Come try our new outdoor pavilion, which we're running till the end of probably November.
It's been so warm, you probably go till December.
Yeah, it was packed yesterday.
Yeah.
The new fall menu is out, and we talked a little bit about it, but it is a wonderful time to come to Terrapin.
So I apologize. We didn't really talk much about that because we talked about Italy and hollandaise sauce.
But that was more fun, so we did what we had to do.
The link is on our webpage, too, Vox Pop. You can just find today's show. Great job. Thanks. We'll see you soon.
Excellent.
Support comes from Bodywork Professionals, licensed massage therapist, Albany, Saratoga Springs, Niskayuna, Nick Pavaldi, structural integration practitioner, Rolfer proprietor, 518-MASSAGE, or bodyworkprofessionals.com. Rolling Rock Farm Salt and Seasonings, working to spread peace, love, and happiness with handcrafted and small batches infused sea salts, pepper, and blends, specializing in black garlic, rollingrocksalt.com. And Broad and Taylor, makers of bread baking tools and equipment for listeners who are interested in beginning their sourdough journey. Recipes, how-to videos, and store at Broad, spelled B-R-O-D, and Taylor.com. That's it. The fun drive begins at 6 a.m. Monday. Pledge now. WAMC.org. We'll see you Monday.